Let's get a sense of where things are politically between the U.S. and Cuba. I mean, think about it. 6 months ago, the U.S. and Cuba had no relationship. Now they're talking about reopening the embassies for the first time since 1961. What happened? Journalist Ann Louise Bardach is one of America's leading Cuba watchers. Over the years, she's interviewed Fidel Castro, written a few books about Cuba. Ann Louise, when President Obama announced in December that he was normalizing relations with Cuba, it took everyone by surprise. How do you explain that?
Well, it was remarkable because everybody knows anything involving Cuba and secrecy is almost impossible. Most famously, during the Bay of Pigs, one of the reasons it went so badly was that nobody in Miami could keep a secret, you know. But, you know, you could see, if you look back at when Raul Castro comes to power first temporarily in 2006, when his brother Fidel falls, you know, terribly, terribly ill, in 2008, when it becomes permanent, he starts making sounds that he's ready for a new relationship with the United States. And at some point, in around 2012, 2013, talks begin to happen. One of the reasons it was kept such a good secret is the Vatican was involved. And the Vatican does know how to keep a secret. And, you know, they know something about confession. And
well, that was the other surprising thing, actually, is that Pope Francis was involved at all in the first place. And secondly, that Raul Castro seems to have enormous respect and admiration for Pope Francis.
Remarkable. We're looking at a new, what I would call the reinvention of Raul Castro. It has a certain logic to it. Pope Francis is a Latin American from Argentina, comes out of the Jesuits. Fidel Castro and his brothers, Raul and other brothers, were all educated in Jesuit schools, very influenced by Jesuit philosophy. And it appears to me that Pope Francis leans very much towards what we used to call liberation theology, which was a kind of a social activism. And he had a very good relationship, and this is the key factor, with Jaime Ortega, the archbishop in Havana. I mean, just to represent the church in such a hostile environment as Cuba is already remarkable, because remember, the church was outlawed. In the early 60s, Fidel sent the church packing, accused them of being a lot of spies.
Right. Well, that's what's so remarkable about the fact that the Pope was involved at all. And then the, supposedly Raul has talked about converting or returning to the church.
He said something quite interesting to Pope Francis. He said, of course, the Cuban Communist Party, by our doctrine, is atheist. And he said something about that could change. And Raul Castro will be, let me see, he's going to be 84 years old on June 6th. He comes from a very religious mother. Most of the members of the inner Castro family, with the exception of Fidel and Raul, have been very devout Catholics. And it could very well be that Raul Castro, who was his mother's favorite, has, in his older age, opened up a space for belief.
So in the meantime, what do we know about Fidel's health? Because he's always seemed like a leader who would just cling with his last strength in his fingernails to his power.
That's exactly the case. His health is terrible. In 2006, he very, very nearly died. In fact, by his own account, he believed he had died. And he had a dramatic weight loss, something like 75, 80 pounds. Most of his organs shut down. He needed radical surgery, lost, you know, his spleen, his gallbladder, most of the colon, and was barely surviving, which is the only reason that his brother, it was announced that the brother would take temporarily the reins, and that was at the end of July 2006.
Well, I was going to ask, does this mean that Raul has finally definitively taken over from Fidel?
Absolutely. That's one point. But there's two points. Neither Castro has been impervious to the bad news out of Venezuela.
And Venezuela is providing, I don't remember how many barrels of oil.
100,000 barrels of oil per day for maybe some exchange for doctors or this, but more than that, and a lot of other subsidies. And by the way, by September of 2014, the Venezuelans very quietly slashed that oil subsidy. They weren't getting the 100,000 barrels. So by September, They knew the writing was on the wall, as well as their own intelligence told them that Nicolas Maduro would very likely not survive another year as running Venezuela, and they were going to lose the whole thing.
Well, so presumably the thought that oil may be going away puts Cuba in a very different position than it ever has been before.
That's absolutely correct. I have no doubt that they made inquiries to Vladimir Putin, and no doubt Putin told them, look, I'm very busy. I just took Crimea. If I'm going to take on another country, it's going to probably be the Ukraine. The Chinese, who they're very close with, said, you know, we really like you, but we'll send you another million bicycles. So this did not come out of virtue. This came out of absolute necessity. Who on earth is going to bail out the Cuban economy?
Right. I'm curious, what do you think normalizing relations will actually change in Cuba on the ground? I mean, for instance, what kind of threat might this pose to the communist government?
Raul Castro has been very clear, and the negotiators for Cuba, to say that do not believe that these negotiations mean, you know, U.S. Western democracy. The primacy of the Cuban Communist Party will remain. What they don't say, but what everybody knows, is the hegemony of the Cuban army. Remember, behind all these financial ventures and hotels and tourism, you go far enough, you will see that most of them are under the control of a group called Galleza or Gaviota. Both of them are organs of the Cuban military.
Well, in the meantime, what you hear a lot in the U.S., from people who have been fascinated by Cuba for years and either have visited or have wanted to visit, what you hear a lot is, see it now before it's all changed. So I think there's this fear, and I think it's on the ground in Cuba too, that, you know, within another 5 years, the Malecón's going to be lined with Hard Rock cafes and Hilton hotels. Do you see that happening in Cuba?
There's definitely going to be change. I do not believe it's going to turn into Miami Beach. It is still very difficult to navigate the Cuban bureaucracy. There's going to be a bit of a reckoning as people run down there thinking, oh my God, great fortune and profits are to be made. You can see it with the ferry issue. So the ferries are approved by the U.S. government. Tampa and various cities in Florida are saying, we're all ready to start. And the Cuban government immediately said, not so fast. Mm-hmm. Because ferries mean people coming in, and they need to maintain the control.
What about the U.S.? And does the U.S. benefit at all from the opening with Cuba?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the primary benefit is it's no longer a source of friction with all our Latin American allies. With the EU, it's always been a big stumbling block. It's always been a problem. Every year it's denounced by the UN.
But so at least it's not such an embarrassment.
Exactly. It removes a real problem. There's always been a issue at every Latin American summit. The U.S. has been chastised about it. Now, that said, I think the idea that it's going to be better for human rights, it's going to be better for democracy, it's going to be better for dissidents, it's going to be better for the media, it's not going to be the case. Look, in March, more than 600 so-called dissident human rights activists were rounded up and arrested. So the arrests go on and on and on. And we haven't seemed to make a dent in that. It's going to be a new day. It's going to be different. But is it going to be, free of repression? Unlikely.
That's longtime Cuba analyst Ana Luisa Bardach. Her books include Without Fidel and Cuba Confidential.